Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff. Today, host Melvin Merritt talks with Troy Robinson, local homeless advocate who has been holding a giveaway of clothes, food, and love on 35th and Prospect and has been hassled by the police for his activities. Also, later in the show, today host Keith Brown L. talks with Hetty Harden, chairman of Missouri Citizens United for the Reform of Errants, Missouri Cure, about their annual conference coming up soon in St. Louis, as well as a couple people that have experienced the problem of having a loved one behind bars. Stay tuned for the calendar of events in the middle of the show and the 420 drug war news at the end of the show. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith, and now to Melvin and his guest.
Good morning, Kansas City. This is Jaws of Justice right here on KKFI 90.1 FM on your dial. In the studio with me is, as it was mentioned, Mr. Troy Robinson. He is the young man who stands on 35th and Prospect holding signs that says, "Hunk for Peace." If you want change, hunk. And so he has various signs that he holds up and try to incorporate the community by honking their horn if they want change or some positive things that within the community. As it was mentioned that he is a homeless advocate and he is actually homeless himself. So at this time, I'm going to welcome Mr. Robinson, Troy Robinson, a young man. And could you give us your age?
I'm 25.
Okay. Welcome to Jaws of Justice.
Thank you.
And I want to ask the first question is, what motivated you to start this thing of holding signs up? And
Basically, first I want to say good morning, Kansas City. Make sure everybody smile today. First, it started when I seen my friends die, you know. I've been losing a lot of friends growing up, so it's like my motivation was to find a way that nobody could do, you know, something that was a silent message, because I didn't want to go around yelling, you know, honk your horn. So I just felt like to put it in a sign. That's the easiest way when you want somebody to notice something, just put it on the sign. That's how I felt. So what motivated me was basically just not liking my friends dying every day, like seeing how many deaths it is in Kansas City. We had 106 right now. It's 106, but probably 107 because it could have something happened
last night.
See, 107 now. So that's what motivated me to keep pushing hard for to better my city.
Sure, and that's a good thing, especially coming from a young man your age, and especially with what's happening. With young men your age. Mm-hmm. So it's going to take young men your age to stand up for something positive. As Jeff alluded to the fact that you were harassed on 35th and what you were doing, mm-hmm. could you tell us a little bit of the reasons of why you were being harassed?
I feel like because that area don't want no peace over there. You know, I think it's the Central Patrol, you know. Mainly, my focus is not with the police. My focus is my community, because I started this when my friends was dying. But the police involved themselves when trying to figure out what they can do to, you know, send me to jail. What am I doing wrong? So I learned within my constitutional rights. Because the day I got out of coma, I got tased by the police. Then I started holding a sign on 35th and Truth, got jumped on by the police. Then I got beat up 3 times on 35th and Prospect. So it's been 5 times altogether in a 5-year process by the same officer. So it's like, you know, they're trying to stop my focus on this, but I keep them, you know, out the way. I let them incriminate themselves, you know. My focus is my community.
Yeah, I happened to was watching TV on that time when that happened, mm-hmm. and I didn't know it was you. I just thought it was another young black male that was on the ground getting ready to be arrested, and I saw something about, you know, where they said that you were not only fighting back, but that you were drowning or swallowing.
See,
your
that was
own.
See them situations. You got August 21st, you got a September 6th, and then like September 10th. I want to say, you know, I'm not.
Yeah.
I'm not sure on the date. So it's like, all these incidents are different. August 21st is when over 35 officers jumped on me. Then another day incident, I got arrested just because they said I falsely called 911. Then right after that, after my big brother funeral, they caught me in the back of the gas station and I was having a seizure and they was like pushing me on my
back. In other words, that when you were supposed to have been swallowing your own saliva, that you were actually having a seizure. And that's your medical situation or issue, is that you have seizures.
Diagnosed with epilepsy.
And with that being said, you use what?
Keppra?
What do you use to, you know, to...
I mean, really, CBD. I like, because I feel like with me, they did an EGG on me, and I have stress-induced epilepsy. So it's like they told me medicine really not going to help, because if you stress, you're just going to go into a seizure. It don't matter how much medicine you take. So it's like me smoking, it relaxes
Smoking marijuana.
Yeah, I mean, marijuana, CBD. Yeah. It was like, you know, I feel like that is what relaxes my body, because without it, my stress, I shake. You know, I have the most, my nerves is like super out of here. And it's not like an excuse. It's just something with epilepsy. You know, it's a misfire in the brain. And when I think about stress, I go into a seizure.
What do you say to people like myself, you know, that I don't advocate marijuana for whatever reasons, because we have so many different negative things within the black community, alcohol, drugs around every corner. Let me finish. And then we have what they call the medicinal purposes of smoking marijuana, whether it's CDP or whatever.
CBD.
Whatever the case may be. And, personally, I think that we don't need another store to open up and dealing marijuana legally for whatever reason. And I know that there's people that advocate this and say that it should be legalized. Maybe so. I don't know. I don't know all the ins and outs, but I do know that there is another alternative rather than opening up something else that is destroying our people's minds. And that's why I do not advocate it. Go ahead and speak.
Okay, you said let the older, from the younger generation to the older generation, let's let you know why I feel like, you know, it's a different way. Okay, do you take prescription, you know, pills? Like,
I think a lot of us do.
I never take medicine. You know what I'm saying? Like, what a plant is a natural grown herb. That's how I would look at it. And it's basically, you can eat it. You don't have to just naturally smoke it. You can put it in food. You can put it, make it oil. You know, it's different ways to cope in a different way. You know, a lot of young people are adapt to smoking because it is a natural plant. It is grown from the earth, you know. So with this being a business here, it's not going to do nothing but generate a lot of money and for the lower income people. See, this is a billion-dollar industry. That's when Freeway Rick Ross came down here and he taught me about it, it was basically the mindset of not thinking of, you know, it's so many people getting arrested for weed instead of now. All them people that was arrested for weed, they have to drop them charges. Now it's more jobs opening up. You know, it's money generated within a city and on a different term of something now that's legal that we can work in with the community.
Sure. You know that we talked about, you know, about you being an example to other young men that may be watching you, because now that you have shook the beehive, so to speak, and you have in one sign that says things that are very positive, and then on the other side of that, you know, there's a blunt or there's marijuana smoking, and you advocate that freely, and I don't knock that. It's just that what type of message is these young people are getting with one side positive, then the other side with all the negative connotations behind it, that, you know, we're saying two different messages.
See, where I'll go with that is, like, it's not a negative message. It's just how you take it. If you never take the time to get out and meet me, then you'll never understand my story. You'll just see somebody just got a blunt in their hand. But in our reality, it's CBD. It's what they sell out the stores. Yeah. So it's like, even when the police drive past, they like, you smoking weed? No, I'm smoking CBD. It's like, it's something that y'all put here, and don't try to, you can't make it a bad thing. Everything is not a bad thing. Even young people, it's not like I'm passing the kids my blunt or something. It ain't, right. I don't condone that, you know? So it's like, you know, teaching them the positive things and letting them know my story. You know, it's a reason why I will always have a blunt.
Absolutely. It's one thing, it's one of the other things that I've read that says that in these times and the times that we're living in is that people are going to begin to call things bad good. And these are the times now that, you know, we're advocating good, and but they're really not good. Mm-hmm. But we're saying that it's not bad. And so with that being said, that, you know, I don't want the broadcast all, you know, completely about marijuana and advocating what's good and what's not. I want to talk more about what your plans are about where you're trying to take this information and this message out. Where are you trying to take it, and what is your plan?
What is my motive? My biggest mission right here with this movement is I want to hunk headquarters, and I want to build it just like the police station. Since, you know, the police station spent all this money on their headquarters, I want a hunk headquarters, and I want kids to come in there and help feed the community. I want them to feel like crime fighters. That's my whole mission with this building, is to make young, give them something to do. Mm-hmm. On the weekends, I want a Scare Straight program. I want a Kansas City Scare Straight where we're not in the jail system, we out in reality. Where we showing the kids.
Scared. I noticed that because I've heard that before. Scared straight.
Yeah.
What do you mean by scared straight?
I mean, you know how it's a lot of parents with bad kids, no guidance, no control.
Right.
Okay. So me being in the streets, I know the streets. So it's like, you know, how about we bring the people in the streets out to show the kids, like, well, you don't want this lifestyle. You don't want to be out here. When they see that reality, you know, when they have to give that helping hand to somebody that don't have it and they got it at home, it sends a mindset thing to them to where they got to realize, like, well, if I leave my mama, I'm not going to have this. If I don't get it right, I'm not going to have this.
Sure.
See, so that's what the Kansas City Scare Straight program going to do on the weekends.
I don't want to put you on a spot, but, you know, when you're saying that you want to have a facility that is about as large as the police department, but with things that are positive, feeding the homeless and having young people in and doing some positive things, what steps are you taking, and what are some of the things, and who are you associating with to make this come to pass?
I mean, right now, I always was taught, like, never let your left hand know what your right hand doing. But I'm taking all the proper steps. I got investors, I got real estate agents, I got a lot of people behind me that's what you call a private sponsor, who's caring about what I'm doing so much that they're like, I'm willing to lend a helping hand, you know, even though I can fund my own things now. Now that the movement is how it is, you know, I'm able to put in process of my dreams. You know, I really want this movement to be where it's just not like a party, it's a movement. It looks like a party, but it's a movement.
And I noticed that at one time that, I don't know if that this is what, you know, were you behind feeding hot dogs or having hot dogs on the corner of 35th and Prospect, and seemed like it was disrupted or some kind of way that you had a couch and stuff like that. And,
oh, see, let me tell you about that. See, what I came up with a Prospect party where it's really not a party, it's a movement. So, okay, that little motive, okay, the owner of Big D's had came out and gave me, he like, you want this couch and this table? So we was sleeping
Big
outside.
D, yeah, the liquor store.
Yeah, the liquor store. Uh-huh. So it was just him seeing us sleeping outside and we ain't had nowhere to sit. He gave us the couch and we had a table right there. So I ended up going to borrow somebody's grill and I'm like, you know, this is going to be the biggest party that anybody ever seen. We're going to look back on this party from now and be like, dang, we came far. And like, it's right here, right now. You know, we started with a grill on the ground. We was giving out, every day I give out free food, free clothes, free shoes, every day, 24/7, 7 days a week.
Now, where do you get these shoes to give out, and where do you get these hot dogs and things at?
I started funding it out of my pocket. Then it got to the point where now I got a storage unit, and I got it full of clothes. I got a smoker, a brand new smoker grill in there, to where if I want to do a bigger barbecue.
And yet you homeless.
Yeah. I mean, my focus is not, you know, at the end of my miracle's coming. You know, I'm not worried about me, because I was too busy focused on myself my whole life. And that's why I feel like the city is messed up, because everybody is worried about them instead of worrying about what we need. You know, everybody won't. Like, when I went to these meetings, they was talking about how a lot of money is getting stolen that they're giving out in grants and stuff. And I'm asking them, well, y'all worried about the wrong things. Why we ain't putting our own money and investing in our own city?
Sure.
So that's where that came from, where I just started seeing how many people didn't care about the city. So it pushed me to focus on my city.
And I really think, and I commend you and applaud you for what you're doing, and especially being a young man and a black male at that too, and with some of the hills that you have to climb in order to achieve what you're trying to achieve. And so I applaud you, and I'm sure that a lot of members in the community that honk their horn think that it's a good thing that, you know, we can have signs out that's pronouncing something positive, you know, honk if you want peace, and some of the other signs you have.
Honk for love, honk for unity, honk for hope, stop the killing, honk for a better day. Hunk for unity. I mean, it's so many signs that I done made a sign every day for a different thing.
So that's good when we can inject something positive in the minds, because we don't know who and what people are going through at the time that they pass through there and they see a sign, hunk for peace, you know, hunk for joy, hunk for love.
Definitely.
And things like that. And we need to have someone to advocate that kind of a thing with so much chaos that is going on, not only in our cities, but in America. Yeah, around the world and just everywhere, you know. I remember I heard someone say, cheer up, it's going to get worse, you know, before it gets better. That's something I heard. I didn't say that. And so, but the way that it's going, that, you know, chaos is operating. And so, but, you know, as much as we can pull some good stuff into our society, within our community, just in the area of where we're at. And I remember a man by the name of Barack Obama said, turn around and see what you can do in your community. And you're doing that. And I can't help but applaud you for doing that. What are some of the other things that you want to do?
A lot of things I want to do is mainly like building up foundation for the city to have. We need buildings of fun. We need the kids to have something to occupy themselves. If they have something to do every weekend, if it's like an event for the kids every weekend that they don't got to pay for it, nobody got to come out the pocket, the community pay for it. True. Do you know that these kids don't want to go to jail because they don't want to miss the event? They don't want to get killed because they don't want to miss the event? So they're not going to do nothing to jeopardize their life or to miss this because the whole Kansas City pitched in. And another thing where people got wrong is the magic of thinking big. It's a book. You know, when people think that it's going to be chaos and not think that it's going to be peace, a lot of the times it's going to be chaos because it's majority of the people just thinking it. You know, when you think big, or how can we find a way to build our community, doors are open in your head like, okay, well, we need this over here. I want to build a school, to be honest. I want to build a school to fix the education system, to teach kids like, well, there's somebody to show you that we can do anything you put your mind to.
Sure. And I applaud you for that. But is it something that you put it on paper, and so businesses that might be interested in getting behind your ideals, because we need fresh ideals, and then we need boots on the ground, so to speak,
of
people, young people that know what's going on within the community, know what's going on in the minds of their peers. And as you just alluded to the fact that most of the young guys your age, they don't want to die, but they want things positive that they're not getting. And so we need someone to step up to the plate and maybe advocate to people with finances that can get behind, even though that they may not do it, but they can. You can be the arm to those people that don't have that same motivation, don't have that same dream, and that they can get behind you.
Of course. I feel like we all we got. I'm big on saying we all we got. We stand together. We unite as one without looking at a color. This world is what you call an unstoppable nation. That's what they mean, because now that we in a generation where I'm 25, but I never yell Black Lives Matter. I feel like all lives matter.
Sure.
My struggle ain't better than nobody else's struggle. My struggle ain't worse than nobody else's struggle. So when people stop being prejudiced to thinking just because somebody else was giving something by their family and our family wasn't giving nothing because we was put in a position, it's big out here. That's why I've been telling, like, the people that I be around, it's not about a color, it's about a life. You know, if we care about each other's life, the people that's looking at a color is gonna show, because you'll see how they really care about people that care about people of color. You know, you don't have to yell Black Lives Matter to show Black Lives Matter. You know, show all lives matter, so everybody feel welcome to come. That's me. I'm All Lives Matter movement.
Yeah, and that's great, but I understand why they said Black Lives Matter.
I definitely
because,
do.
Because of
it's
the fact
been happening
that
so
much to black young male women, and so I think that's one of the reasons why they stood up on the soapbox, so to speak, and say, hey, Black Lives do matter.
Have you noticed this, though, with that saying, like, it caused a lot of riots, it caused a lot of confusion, when really they just wanted Black Lives to matter. My movement, I have never got in trouble. I mean, I've been in my interaction with the police, but that was them just giving me charges, you know, falsifying charges and stuff. But I have never gotten arrested nowhere else, no matter where I went. And all I said was...
So you wasn't stealing or dealing drugs?
I mean, when I was 17, I caught felonies behind hanging around the wrong crowd. But okay. that was it. I did my time. When I was 21, I got off probation. I ain't been in trouble ever since then, like, no major cases or nothing. It was just when I was 17, they tried me as an adult. When I was 16, they waited till I turned 17, tried me as an adult. So it was like, you know, it was a lesson to me about being around the wrong crowd, the wrong people. So it was like, you know, I never really had friends.
Speaking of that, you know, and you're talking about being around the wrong crowd, what about some of the crowds that might gravitate to you? And is there a reason why they're gravitating to you that might be members or people that generally hang with the wrong crowd?
With change is going to come not easy, let me say. So with that being said, it's like I meet all type of people. In this movement, I meet all type of people. But my job is to not let them just steer me wrong or do something that I don't allow, because it's like I have to speak on it. I can't bite my tongue. So if somebody doing something that I don't do over here, I speak on it. You know, they have to understand why I'm making a change. You know, I'm changing myself within a movement. You know, just recently I stopped drinking, you know, after they gave me that Versed in my arm. But that's mixing that with alcohol causes to stop in your breathing.
Sure.
You know, so it was like I felt like my life was on the line, so I had to stop myself within, you know, changing myself. So this movement is going to change people within themselves. I'm not going to force it to you like, well, you need to change. I'm going to show you why you need to change.
Okay. Well, we're down to our last minute. And is let's say, for instance, if someone wanted to get in touch with you and possibly even assist you in what you're doing and want to contact you, could you give us a contact number?
816-655-8733. And I got a Facebook, Troy Robertson, if you want to see, like, the events. I share the events I've been doing. I've been sleeping outside since July 5th straight, just day and night, you know, not worried about going to nobody's house for the community. Because okay. We are the people, and we come together as one, and ain't going to be no stopping.
Real quickly, give that number again in case they didn't have a pencil or pen.
816-655-8733.
Thank you, Kansas City. You have been listening to Jaws of Justice right here, and my guest was Troy Robertson, young man, 25, that stands on the corner of 35th and Prospect, promoting positiveness, and you go out and have a great day.
Now, the calendar for the week of September 16th. The unethical conduct of former Jackson County Assistant Prosecutor Amy McGowan has been revealed by the release of Ricky Kidd. Many others are wrongfully imprisoned because of her, and now she is an assistant prosecuting attorney in Douglas County, Kansas. You are invited to join and support KC Freedom Project, Mothers of Incarcerated Sons and Daughters, and Sankofa for KC, Monday, September 16th, from 3 to 6 p.m. at the Douglas County Court Building, 111 East 11th Street, Lawrence, Kansas. They will be a voice for justice, traveling to warn citizens in Lawrence, Kansas, about Amy McGowan. There are a limited number of seats available on the bus. For more information, you can call 816-456-9776 or check out the KC Freedom Project page on Facebook. Survivors Unite is uniting families who have lost a loved one to violent crime. They understand that grief is experienced in different stages and help families heal and learn to properly release their emotions. Survivors United meets every third Monday of the month and will meet Monday, September 16th, 7 p.m. at Margaret's Place, 7217 Troost, KCMO. The Kansas City Chapter of Missouri Citizens United for the Rehabilitation of Errants will have their monthly meeting Monday, September 16th, 6 p.m. at the Chestnut Avenue Family Resource Center, 3811 Chestnut Avenue, KCMO. Missouri Cure advocates for the human rights of prisoners in Missouri prisons and jails, as well as those who have returned to society, by lobbying state and local government, direct contact with corrections officials, and a quarterly newsletter sent to supporters and prisoners. My name is Jeff, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn.
This morning on Jaws of Justice Radio, we will be talking to Ms. Hetty Harden, who is the chairperson of Missouri Cure, Citizens United for the Rehabilitation of Errants. We will be talking to Ms. Harden about the upcoming statewide conference in St. Louis, Missouri, to be held on September 28, 2019. The theme for this year's conference will be the impact of incarceration on women and children. Later in the show, we will be joined by Ms. Latara Smith, who is the director of the KC Freedom Project, and Ms. Beb Livingston, director of Mothers of Incarcerated Sons and Daughters. Both these women have had family members who were incarcerated, and we invited them to come and share their experiences with us today. My name is Keith Brownhill. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. I guess we want to start off talking about the conference this year. Could you tell the audience a little bit about that?
Hi, everybody. This is Hetty Harden, chair of Missouri Cure Prison Reform Organization. And we're having our conference, our annual conference in St. Louis this year in North County at Bell Fountain Neighbors Recreation Center, 9669 Bell Fountain Road. It's being sponsored by Bell Fountain Neighbors Mayor Tommy Pearson, who's a former state representative and pastor of Greater St. Mark's Family Church, and he's best known for his support of Ferguson protesters, provided sanctuary to protesters during the uprising following the police murder of Michael Brown. Our keynote speaker will be Andrea James from Boston, Massachusetts. Andrea was a defense attorney for many years in the community and went to prison, federal prison, for 2 years for wire fraud. Ever since she's been out, she's been advocating for women prisoners and girls. She is the founding CEO of the National Council for Incarcerated and Formerly Incarcerated Women and Girls. They have a national campaign going to free female lifers, victims of abuse, and those with serious or terminal illnesses. Do you want me to keep going?
Yes, by all means.
Okay. A quilt will be on display showing the names of about 50 women prisoners in Missouri as part of the clemency campaign. They're trying to bring awareness to the governors of each state that there's a need to use their powers of clemency. Judy Henderson, who was pardoned by Governor Greitens and who spearheads the campaign in Missouri, will be present. Mm-hmm. Stacey Lambert, also pardoned by Governor Greitens, is now an attorney with the St. Louis Public Defender's Office, and she'll be on hand as well. All are welcome to attend. Lunch will be provided. No reservations are needed, but we do need names and a head count to provide enough food. So if you could call 314-730-2873 or email HettyHarden995@gmail.com. And I'll repeat that later.
How long has this conference been in the making?
This is, I believe, our 16th conference, but CURE has been around, Missouri CURE has been around since 1990, so 29 years.
Mm-hmm. Do you happen to know how many women there are incarcerated in the state of Missouri?
No, I'm afraid I don't have that exact number.
Well, I imagine that, well, do you have a ballpark figure?
Well, let's see. We apparently have about 30,000 prisoners. I would say at least 3,000 women.
Mm-hmm. And that's down from previously 35,000?
It was at one time 34,000, yeah, a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's down to 27 or 28, I think.
And this just recently came about when they got on this campaign about reducing the prison population. I want to say letting people out of prison, but it's not about letting people out of prison. It's about being able to manage DE institutions and the facilities.
Yeah, it's about money, and it's about the lack of correctional officers. And part of that is because they're low paid. But there's, you know, a lot of reasons. They also, I think, have come to the conclusion that there's no way to just keep growing the prison system. It was getting bigger and bigger every year, and now the trend is in the opposite direction, thank goodness. Unfortunately, to really fight mass incarceration, you have to do more than just release nonviolent prisoners. You have thousands and thousands of prisoners who had a violent crime when they were young and have aged out of crime. They've been in 20, 30 years. Or more, and until that's dealt with, you're not going to appreciably reduce the prison population.
When you say they've been incarcerated for 20 and 30 years, that's in the lower rim of the average time that most prisoners are incarcerated if they have a violent offense, right?
As far as their sentence, right?
Yeah, I mean,
they virtually all of them now have 85% of their sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And you have people who have been sentenced to over 700 years.
Mm-hmm.
without it even being a murder case. So it's ridiculous.
Tell us a little bit about the conference. You usually have workshops at the conference, am I correct?
Yeah. We're going to present awards. We're going to have entertainment provided by praise dancers. And four breakout sessions or workshops will be held, one on women in prison, one on life sentences, one on overall prison conditions, and one on abuses and segregation.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the awards, we have a Courageous Citizen Award, John Mark Taylor Award, Rory Ellinger Award, Courageous Prisoner Award, and for the first time, we're going to have a Lifetime Achievement Award. Denise Ward Brown, she's a media professor at Washington University. She's working on a film highlighting medical abuses in prison, and she'll be videotaping some of the workshops.
Mm-hmm. And And will that video be available for those who are not able to attend?
I will have to check with her on that. She's working on a film, and this is part of it, so hopefully it will be available.
And Ms. Brown is a professor over at Washington University, am I correct?
Yes, a black woman and a full professor. Mm. We've worked with her in the past, and we'll be working with her on this film as well.
And she teaches media, is that right?
Yeah, media, filmmaking and all types of media.
Well, it sounds...
We're also going to recognize former prisoners and family members and loved ones who support prisoners. Mm-hmm. We think that that's very important. It's difficult. You can speak to that to be able to get out and stay out. And people couldn't do much without the support of loved ones while they're in there.
Right. Are there any other prisoners' rights organizations that you know of in St. Louis that aid prisoners as far as facilitating their release or helping them stay out on the streets?
There are a few that do help with reentry. One I know of is Criminal Justice Ministries, and they have an excellent program. Unfortunately, it only is able to accommodate small number of people as it grows, but they have a great program as far as helping prisoners when they get out to find housing and jobs, and they have support groups, and we have some of our CURE members who are part of that program.
Why do you think people who have been in prison need help when they get out? Why do you think they need to be released?
Well, first of all, you sure can't learn how to be a law-abiding citizen while you're in a cage.
Right.
And people it needs to be the first thing that's done when someone goes to prison is to start preparing them for release.
Right.
If corrections is the actual goal of imprisonment, then it shouldn't be just warehousing.
Okay, now, what problems do you frequently run into in your work with CURE when you're advocating for prisoners' rights?
The biggest problem is, of course, the DOC, because the culture is entrenched as far as abusing prisoners and treating them as less than human. They have huge health care issues because the health care provider is private and exists for profit instead of for, human health. And people are getting older and older in prison because of these long sentences. And as they get older, they have more medical problems. And prisoners lose hope if they don't have some hope of getting out, something to look forward to and someone to support them. So it's so important that they have a plan once they get there of how and when they're going to get out. And then once they get out, they need support from the community because their life is totally different in prison. It's an alternate reality.
We hear this phrase, mass incarceration, being frequently used in Missouri CURE and just about everywhere when we address the problems of people being incarcerated. At what point does incarceration become mass incarceration? And what do we have to do to just bring the numbers back down to where they're just simply incarceration rather than mass incarceration? How many people constitute mass incarceration?
I remember when I first started Missouri CURE back in 1990, I believe there were about 11,000 prisoners in Missouri. And now it's like triple that. So in the 90s, when legislation was passed and tough on crime laws were passed, and Missouri used federal money to build 5 new prisons, that's what mass incarceration turned into. More prisons, tougher laws, harder to get out. It's just, it's like a conspiracy to enslave our population. And slavery is exactly what it is, because even the 13th Amendment of the Constitution says that slavery should be abolished except for those convicted of a crime. So slavery is actually legal in prison, which is why prisoners make little or no money. They actually have to pay taxes with no representation. They cannot vote, and they are abused in so many ways, and there's no monitoring of the system, so the public don't know about most of what goes on.
Well, I certainly hope that our listeners are taking in what you had to say today, and your interview has been very insightful. I have to move on because we have another guest here in the studio, and I want to Miss Latara Smith, and I want to talk to her a little bit about her own personal experiences. We're still waiting on Miss Livingston to call in, and I'd like to thank you, Miss Harden, for your insightful information.
Thank you.
Good morning, Latara. How you doing?
Good morning. I'm blessed. How are you?
Well, I guess I'm blessed. I'm up walking around on 2 feet, so that's about as good as it gets right now.
Amen.
Can you tell us a little bit about, give us a little background about your situation, the work you were involved in, and, you know, the experiences you had. You were formerly incarcerated at one time yourself, right?
Yes, I was.
Give us a little bit of insight into your experiences in incarceration, and you also had a family member incarcerated as well, right?
Yes, I sure have. I am now the director of the Casey Freedom Project, which is a ministry here in Kansas City, Missouri, a nonprofit, and we fight to exonerate and vindicate individuals who are innocent and wrongly convicted. We offer so many pro bono cases a year to investigate cases, to help individuals to prove their innocence so they can get back in in court and fight for their freedom. Yes, I am a formerly incarcerated woman. I served 10 and a half months within the Federal Bureau of Prisons, and I've been home now almost 20 years. So praise God for that. Mm-hmm. I'm from Oklahoma, okay, and Oklahoma is one of the states that has the highest number of incarceration of women. Actually, Missouri is also on that list for the top 10, in the top 10 states. Missouri hits that list, too, for the highest number of states that incarcerate women. And incarceration is difficult, very difficult, whether you're a man or a woman, but I think kind of for women it's a little bit more difficult because we have children that we leave out while we go in.
Exactly.
And we all know that when you have a parent, and even in sometimes, and I've seen this quite a bit in the federal system, where you have a mother and a father, and both get indicted on the same case, and both get sent to prison. So you take the mother and the father away, and you leave the children without anyone. Or to be, you know, with their grandparents who may be elderly, and it's just very hard for them to raise them. It's difficult. It's difficult for women because when we come out of prison, we have to reestablish. Many times the brothers, when they get out, they don't have custody of the children. So they don't have to immediately, they don't have the pressures that us women have coming out, because we have to obtain housing. We have to get the kid, if their kids are in CPS custody and they have not been totally removed by the state because of a mom being incarcerated for so long. You know, after so long, the state will terminate a woman's rights to their children if they're incarcerated and don't get out before that, whatever time that is, you know, with whatever state that they're in. So we kind of get out and we have more pressures because we've got to obtain housing. We've got to get the kids back, whether it's from a caregiver or whether it's from a state foster care system. We've got to, you know, oh my God, we're just walking in. I know I walked in to being homeless because I lost my home while I was gone. I walked into my children. I had a son who had caught some juvenile cases, because what happens when you remove the mom, and the mom is I was a single parent family.
Right.
So when you took me, you took everybody.
Right.
So what happens with the kids? They fall in the cracks. And my son caught juvenile cases. Actually, I was released from prison October 18th, 2002. Okay, that following Monday, I was in juvenile court with my son fighting for his freedom. I mean, literally, I was out for 3 days. I was in court fighting for his freedom and having to step in and intervene because the state of Oklahoma was getting ready to charge my mother with abandonment and take my son because my mother just refused to go get him out of juvenile because he was giving her such a hard time while I was gone. And that happens because the kids don't know what to do. Their main supporter is gone. You know, sometimes leaving your children with family members may work out. For me, it didn't work out. You know, I probably would have been better putting my children in the foster care system, to be quite honest with you. But so I walked out to that. I walked out to having to go to juvenile hearings. You know, my daughter, I have a daughter who was sexually assaulted while I was in prison. That happened. You know, my daughter was raped while I was in prison.
Was this in the home environment or somewhere out on the street?
Well, actually, she was at home by herself, and my landlord came over to collect rent, and my sister was not there, and my daughter was raped. And so even to this day, we still deal with that because it affected her. You know, I mean, it's still affecting her, even as an adult.
How old was she at the time?
She was in the eighth grade.
Oh, my
so,
God.
So, you know, your first sexual experience, you're raped, an older person, you know. I mean, and this happened, you know, when I was gone to prison. So, you know, I had to get over that hump where I blamed myself because, you know, if I didn't participate in what I participated in or knew about something and didn't tell, that's what sent me to prison. I knew about some things that were going on and I didn't tell, so that got a conspiracy charge against me. And so, you know, I want to say this to some of the women: if you're dating boyfriends and they're ballers and drug dealers, and if you're, you know, hey, there is something called conspiracy. Now, that wasn't my deal. I knew about some bank fraud that was going on, and I didn't tell on the people at the time, so they charged me with conspiracy. So, you know, be careful. Just know that there is a charge with the feds called conspiracy, and it's not hard to get that type of charge put on you. You know, I mean, it's not. It happens. Like, seriously, it does. I would have never thought that I would have gone to prison. Never.
Is that what part of what they call the RICO Act?
I believe so.
Now, this deadline that you have, you say you have so much time after you go to prison to get your affairs straight with your, or they'll come and take your children away.
Well, that's if your kids were in CPS, were, was in CPS custody while you were incarcerated. If you don't have, I don't think a lot of people understand this, if you don't have a family member that the state can place your children with, sometimes family members don't meet the requirements because sometimes you have families where everybody is a felon or people can't pass drug tests or whatever the case may be. And in my case, my mother was elderly. So, you know, to put six kids on an elderly woman was just very, very tough for my mother. So my sister, Tanya, and my mother, they split, you know, and both kind of stepped in and took care of my children. And I commend my sister, LaTanya, for doing that.
You have six kids?
At that time, I had six. I have eight children, but at that time, I had six. I have one that already has gone to be with the Lord, and then I had one once I came out of prison because I had remarried. So I had a baby with my second husband. But if it's a case where the kids are in child welfare custody, then yes, in Oklahoma, those women have 2 years to get their affairs in order, and if not, the state can move to terminate their rights to their children, and a lot of women lose their kids like that. So once I did get out of federal prison, I had a year timeline before I could go and apply to be a programmatic volunteer with Oklahoma Department of Corrections. And I've been a volunteer with Oklahoma Department of Corrections for almost 20 years. Okay. Well, 19 years, because I got it roughly about a year after I got out. And what I would do would be going working with the women in the halfway houses, doing the wraparound reentry programs, going into the prison, teaching classes. And then also for women who had court hearings. Sometimes they have court hearings, and if they don't go, then those courts, they win by default, and those women literally lose their children. So that was part of what my ministry did in Oklahoma, Dedicated Women of Christ Prison Ministries. We would actually pick up those women, take them from the halfway house, and transport them Oklahoma City or whatever county they were from in Oklahoma so that they could appear at those hearings and not lose their children, you know.
Now, what happens, like, in a situation where a woman may have a lengthy period of time to serve in prison. And initially, the kids are in a stable home environment. If something happens later on to destabilize that home environment, what happens to the children then?
9 times out of 10, those children go in foster care. And like in the federal system.
Does the 2-year deadline start when they go into foster care?
I'm not really for sure, but I know that if they are someplace and they're removed from whatever caregivers they have, the state will most definitely step in. I've seen that happen. I've seen where we have women who come into federal prison. Now, I don't know how the state prisons do it, but in the federal system, if a woman comes in and she's pregnant, then she actually can go to a facility that they have where they can go after they have their baby, and they get to keep their baby with them for a certain amount of time, and then they have to send that baby out. But they do allow them time to bond and to be with their children. I really don't know how many months it is, but it's a few. And they send them out. And if they have no one to send them to, those kids have to go to foster care.
Now, on this bonding situation, how effective is that if you give a woman who gave birth to a child while she was incarcerated, and you allow her to have a certain amount of time to bond with the child? How effective is that if a woman has a lengthy period of time to serve? Say she's going to be in prison 15 years. Does that have any impact on the child to go back and recall the bonding period if they're able to do that or anything? I mean, is it something like she's just maybe just a total stranger when she gets out? Now, like, the child is like, I really don't know you because you've been in prison all my life.
Well, I mean, of course that would probably be, you know, the take from the child. I mean, unless the mother's going to get out while the child is still an infant. You know what I'm saying? A toddler, maybe. You know, but if that mom is going to be in there a long time, it's I can't see where they would be able to remember. Now, I do know that it blesses the mom. It most definitely helps the mother to be able to establish that bond with their child. But, you know, and in the state system, they don't have it at all. They have their babies and they're gone immediately from the hospital.
That's very sad. What kind of advice can you give to women who have had this experience with losing their children? What steps do they take once they get out? Say they've been locked up 10 to 15 years, they get out, and they want to reconnect with their family. What process do they have to go through in order to retain their children?
Well, I think that would depend per case, because sometimes they may be restricted to communication with the children. If it's a situation where they lost their kids by default judgment, maybe they can get back in court and address that issue and try to get back in and reverse the default judgment. You know, I would say that would be something probably that they could do.
But there's never statute of limitations that would prevent you from being able to do that.
I'm not for sure. Mm-hmm. I'm not for sure.
And well, it probably would vary from state to state then, right?
Probably so.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, we only have less than a minute to wrap up our show. Do you have anything that you would like to comment on that you would like the audience to know about the impact of incarceration on women and children?
Well,
one final thought.
Well, my final thought, and I got to be quick. Our numbers of incarceration of women are too high, and I think that we need to start looking at other programs for women. Okay, maybe some community sentencing and not locking up so many women, because it literally destroys a home when we take the mother out of that environment.
Well, I sure like to thank you for being here today, and your information you've been providing to us has been very helpful, and I hope our audience will be able to get something from that and be able to avoid those type of situations.
It's the 420 Drug War News. This is part of a conversation held at a convention in Austin dealing with marijuana. The first speaker you hear is retired police lieutenant from Houston, Jay Hall.
Mm-hmm. And you're talking about a substitution effect when it comes to different drugs, and the same thing when it comes to legalization. Mm-hmm. So basically, we're talking about supply and demand.
Right.
So if you legalize drugs in the other states, then yes, it is possible, if it's not legalized in Texas, that you could have a black market effect, which would mean that you would have increased profits. You would have more law enforcement being alerted to those type of situations. You would have more violent crimes as a result of that. So, yeah, the black market is very real.
You know, often it seems like probable cause is used by officers to sort of just get into a person's vehicle, or Has that been your experience, the scent of marijuana, anything like that, just to sort of, you know, how is probable cause used in terms of marijuana arrest in your experience?
Well, it affects police practices.
Okay.
One of the things that I always like to point out is that ever since 1914, the Harrison Act, mm-hmm. fear has driven the marijuana debate.
Okay.
And so when you have fear driving the debate, we have framed the marijuana issue into a zero-sum game.
Okay.
Somebody has to win, someone has to lose. The winners in the marijuana debate have been the drug cartels,
right.
The prison systems, the politicians who have a get tough on crime, the grant writers mm-hmm. who provide financial incentives for writing and getting grant monies for. But the losers have been patients like veterans, mass incarceration individuals, and taxpayers.
Mm-hmm.
They have to pay these bills. In New York, they had, I think I was just looking at a note, they had, for possession of marijuana in New York, they had a situation where they had like 400,000 arrests, and that bill, well, it took officers off the street,
mm-hmm.
number one.
Right.
So when those officers are off the street, what takes place is that other major crimes are not being investigated. The clearance rates are lower.
That was Lieutenant Jay Hall, and I am Dean at DrugTruth.net.
Sitting here in my problem. What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.